The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
In the sense that there are multiple opposed interests, there are multiple social contradictions which are not reducible to an ultimate one. And there are therefore multiple agents for change of the conditions, and their interests do not necessarily coincide. If this renders the transnational class-based politics of Marxism vulnerable to the criticisms of intersectional analysis, it may be all to the better. But in making this transition, we are likely to lose the kind of normative or orientation that Marxist politics once provided. Accordingly, I would contend with Marcus, politics is to a large degree really a pragmatic matter, which has to address concrete problems, concrete needs, concrete contradictions in a given country at a given point in history. The aim of the unification of theory and practice was to some degree disastrous, both for practice and for theory. It resulted in the dogmatism of leftist practice in one sense, when, let's say, measures like the nationalization of this or that were a priori decided to be progressive independently of concrete conditions or ends. On the other hand, for theory, it often meant accommodation to the existing forms of political practice. In this regard, Marcus is, quote, not speaking about East Europe, where this accommodation was enforced, but about the West. There often was a lack of critical distance to leftist political practice. Under conditions of late modernity, when Marxism is no longer a significant political force, when the heterogeneous and irreducible oppressions give the lie to the so-called revolutionary subject of history, and by extension call into question the very possibility of a universal critical theory understood as its necessary self-consciousness, Marcus further questions the desirability of such a project. One can detect this questioning of the desirability of a unified Marxism, moreover, in the manner through which it is understood as a cultural form. Nowhere is this more evident than in the paper Debates and Trends in Marxist Philosophy. Since Agnes Heller is about to touch on this, I will limit my remarks upon it to two observations. When Marcus employs the term cultural form, he uses it in a very precise sense to refer to the normative relations of production and reception that reciprocally condition the horizon of expectations in relation to which complexes of meaning are determined as admissible modalities of meaning. Strictly speaking, these are not posited literally in by the text itself, but in the, quote, transtextual form of the work. Utilizing this notion of cultural form, the paper on Debates and Trends may be understood as a polemic, at least in part, against the cultural hegemony of the party as the sole bearer of the, quote, standard conception of Marxism, and in particular against its methodological assumption that only a single unified and universally valid. Marxism was possible and desirable. In opposition, Marcus delineates three further trends of Marxism than evident in Eastern Europe. With more or less equal claim upon having been inspired by Marx, these trends neither can be reduced to a common methodology, nor may they be construed as such to be so many debates internal to the official Marxism of the party. The juxtaposition of these trends thereby suggested that the debates were among the trends in the plural rather than within a monistically conceived theory. The conclusion of this paper endorses pluralism not in the sense of a syncretic philosophical content manifesting within a trend, but as an assumption conditioning the cultural practice of critical inquiry itself. Among the trends he identifies, Marcus broadly aligns himself with that of social ontology, which, contrary to the dialectical and historical materialism representing the so-called standard conception, sought to understand the plethora of natural, social, and spiritual phenomena in terms of their eminently human significance sui generis, rather than as a set of unified and continuous laws of development grounded in nature itself. Marcus's conception of Marxism was thereby to have a profound effect upon the way in which he later construed the natural sciences as a cultural form. To account for the irreducibly human modality pertaining to the world of human beings, its objects and potentialities, Marx's conception of social ontology found in Marx's notion of human essence an alternative to the classical contest between realism and nominalism. I cannot go into all the details of Marx's unrivaled study, Marxism and Anthropology, but two points in the conclusion deserve a special mention. In Marx's interpretation of species essence, this concept is construed through a paradigm of labor. This does not mean the old and misguided dichotomy between human activity and the lagging consciousness. For Marcus, the historicity of the species essence is a socially mediated and conscious form of objectivity, the yield of labor of human beings, continual metabolism with nature on the one hand, and of the inherited totality of object skills and abilities previously made. There are two aspects of the labor process deserving notice: the selective appropriation and objectification of these same object skills and abilities encompassed by the term species essence. With the clarification of selective appropriation, Marcus suggests that the species essence is not merely the totality of all previous objectivations, but of those that are determined to serve the needs of the present. It is the conception of objectivation that is hereby construed through the paradigm of labor. For what is given as a result of the labor process is not merely some object, but a more or less explicit set of norms referring to its use. The conscious dimension attendant to this process This entails then not merely the acquisition of know-how and the instrumental sense, but of an implicit validation of these norms. Insofar as labor is herein considered the paradigmatic form of objectivation, the heuristics of this account render at least two observations necessary. On the one hand, the general teleological structure of labor is construed on the level of the species as a whole and upon that of particular individuals. The acquisition of skills and capacities to effectively utilize the objectivations of human essence are present in each and all normal members of the species. To this end, the paradigm of labor considers human essence as second nature. While this conception may profoundly introduce the critical notion of alienation in several of its key senses, it does not provide for any account of the social relations demarcating the various historical epochs. The latter are not merely ephemeral, but also are rendered objective through the performance of certain tasks and in relation to certain goals, in which determine who may selectively appropriate species essential objectivations, in what manner, under what conditions, and for what purposes. For Marcus, these further determinations of social objectivation are found in the paradigm of production. Starting in the Grundriss, Marx began to make a clear distinction between the paradigm of labor and that of production. The latter, as we well know, was offered on the basis of a critical analysis of commodity production as a distinct form of social objectivations determined historically through the fulfillment of the functional roles of capital and labor. By interpreting modern societies through the paradigm of capital production, Marx's account has proved, under pains of historical experience, to be rather limited. Thus, when Marcus interprets the Marxian paradigm, he does so in a way that considers the framework more abstractly, which has a twofold significance. On the one hand, it permits his use of the paradigm of production to claim equal validity in the criticism of capital production, on the one hand, and of that occurring in the Soviet dictatorship over needs. On the other hand, this more abstract conception allows Marcus to reject the so-called base superstructure metaphor by considering the distinctive mode of cultural production, one capable of integrating with it the relations of material production. And so we come to the issue of culture as a type of objectivation, which is irreducible to the form of objectivity premise on the commodity. In doing this, we can both look back and look forth. In the Debates and Trends essay, the key axis of interpretation for Marge was the notion of extent. To what does Marxist philosophy extend to? And it turns out that the paradigm of production, if construed in this abstract way, will extend further than the Marxian account. Right? And so this is, in some respects, a good thing. This allows us to see that in Marxism and anthropology, that the selective appropriation and objectivation of the species essence is consistent with an anthropological conception of culture. Now, the real interest of the later Marcus, though, is about the specific modality of the objectivation of high culture. And that's where I wanted to end, and perhaps we can talk about this more. For him, high culture is intelligible through the paradigm of production, through a set of sui generis cultural relations understood as uniting author or creator, the work, and the recipient. This is where I would like to end for today.
Thank you very much. Now we'll have Agnes Heller speak.
Thank you. It was very interesting what Jonathan said. I will approach Marcus a little bit from different position. I know this is a conference on Marx, so I have to emphasize the Marcus's relationship of to Marx, but I won't do that. Only marginally, because I speak about Marcus as an independent thinker. Everyone who knows Marcus knows about his history, that his father was killed in Holocaust, that he was with his mother and his sister, was rescued by having false papers, false identification. And after he finished high school, he went to the Soviet Union and became student at Lomonosov University, where he studied philosophy. Here comes the first interesting point. In the Soviet Union, he learned very little about Marx. In the Soviet Union, he was not really interested in Marx. In the Soviet Union, he rather became interested in philosophy of science, because his major teachers were teaching him philosophy of science and epistemology. Though he decided that is what he's going to do in his life, philosophy and science and epistemology. Once upon a time, Marcus spoke about Lukács, and he said that in Lukács's case, you can establish a kind of theory of continuity and also a theory of discontinuity. The same thing can be said about Marcus. So what I'm going to speak about is whether Marcus's development, philosophical development, is continuous or discontinuous. Whether something happened when he entered Australia and he was already in his 30s, early 30s, whether it happened that changed entirely his position, his view about the world, or rather not, but just he turned a little bit away from his previous occupation and turned another kind of occupation. So start with young Marcus, who just came to Budapest from the Soviet Union, the time when I got to know him. When he started to write in Hungary, mainly he wrote books about philosophy of science. One of his first books was a work written together with Zsádor Tordai. The title of the work is Contemporary Bourgeois Philosophers. That was an idea of contemporary bourgeois philosophers. Marcus wrote about Popper, about Wittgenstein, etc. And Tordai, the other one, wrote about existentialism, phenomenology, and even about Marx. Not Marcus. However, at the same time, he was already interested in culture. He was one of the students of George Lukács, and he wrote two very important pieces on the work of Lukács, on Lukács's aesthetics. One of the papers was titled The Soul and the Life. That is a kind of modification of the title of Lukács's first book, The Soul and the Form. He spoke about soul and love. It was a little bit Lukács interpretation, Lukács criticism, rather interpretation. And he was the one who first read the Heidelberg Aesthetics and the Philosophy of Art, two manuscripts by Lukács, which were unknown in Hungary, unknown in the world in general, because they were in the safe of a bank of Heidelberg. And since the safe of the bank was not opened, it was opened only in the 60s, this manuscript became known by the world, and it's a very old-fashioned German handwriting. Markus deciphered his handwriting wonderfully, because he knew what Lukács ought to have said in this place, and should have said, and he guessed it properly. And then he wrote a beautiful preface to his work, one of the best things ever written about the philosophy of young Lukács, the Lukács before 18. And that is, he already was interested in aesthetic issues. They are not so far away from Walter Benjamin or Adorno, what he did in this essay. But at the same time, he emphasized also that young Lukács was interested in epistemology, what he was not. But for Markus, it was a point why he approaches Lukács, because he was also interested in epistemology. So when interestingly, he had already elaborated two later topics of his work. First, he wanted to find what the function of culture is among the different social functions. Markus spoke about a variety of social functions, and he believed that culture is one among those functions, and we have to understand culture as one among those functions. At the same time, we already distinguish between two kinds of culture, two kinds of concept of culture. One concept, he said, is high culture, that is culture, and everything else is non-culture. The other is a broader concept. He hasn't said what this broader concept was. Later on, he speaks about the anthropological concept of culture, but at that time, he did not mention it. He spoke as a broader and a more concentrated concept of culture. The main book, one of the main books written, however, was still a book on Marx. A book Jonathan mentioned and even discussed, this was the book about anthropology, that is the anthropology, Marxism and anthropology, in quotation mark. It was on quotation mark, should not be misread. Anthropology, it's not about Aboriginal people in Australia or Torres Strait Island. It's about the human essence. That's a philosophical conception. Anthropology is a philosophical anthropology, not as an anthropology as modern science. Now, this book has a great significance. It became a classic. It became a classic, and from different positions, it was a kind of Marx interpretation in which Markus already took into consideration what was so important by him later, that the text itself stands higher than the interpreter. That is, the interpretandum stands always higher than the interpreter. That is, the text of Marx can be interpreted a thousand different ways, and it will be not exhausted. One interpretation can contradict the other interpretation, but none of them is faulty. None of them is a kind of heresy. There is no heresy in interpretation. All interpretations have a right on their own, because the interpretandum anyhow stands higher than interpretation. So he started to interpret young Marx. I was concentrating on young Marx. I have to tell you that he was always concentrating on young Marx, and when he spoke about the Capital, he rather did it always in a critical way. About this I will speak a little bit later on. But he was so fascinated with the young Marx, especially with the Paris manuscripts. And here very interesting things happened. The person who was so much involved in epistemology wrote a Marx interpretation which does not tolerate the very existence of any kind of epistemology. That was just the opposite of every epistemological approach to our world and to philosophical problems. This work is as close to Heidegger as possible, to Zeinon Zeit. Why is that so? Because by Marx, the central point is generic essence, Gattungswesen. Yeah? Men, we are Gattungswesen, generic essence. That is, every single person is Gattungswesen, and the whole Gattung, that is, the whole human species, as a human species, is embodied in each and every single human person. And then he speaks about Marcuse's expression about the constituents of human essence. This word is not used by Marx, but that was a very strong and very correct interpretation that the human essence, Gattungswesen, has constituents. What are these constituents? Leber, yeah? Paradigm of Leber was not really a paradigm at that time. Leber, that is a social animal, yeah? Like Aristotle said, a social being, then third freedom and universality. And these are the four constituents of the human race. And each and every person is born into these constituents. That is, this is not that we are here and the world is there, and we have to figure out what is there, which we do not know. Because we are already freedom, we are already teleological beings, we are already social beings, and we are already universal beings. It is the human essence embodied in every single individual. I think that, of course, at that time, Marcuse did not know Heidegger. He never liked Heidegger. He disliked Heidegger utterly. I don't discuss this much because I discussed it with him. But anyway, this interpretation is a Dasein analysis. Whether Heidegger or non-Heidegger, it is a Dasein analysis. It's a wonderful interpretation of the work of the young Marx. Now, I come back to what you said, because Marx had not one philosophy, as every significant philosopher. He approached the problem of different perspectives. Then already in the Feuerbach chapter, there's a different understanding of history. And of course, in Capital, it's again a different understanding of history, in the Grundrisse also. So in A Critique of the Gotha Program, he returns to the Paris manuscript, he returns to his youth. Anyway, he experiments with different kind of position, different kind of understanding. What does he want to understand? He wants to understand the modern world, the modern world. And here I think there is something very much in common between Marx, Lukács, György Marcos, I want to say the same level, but still common. They want to understand the modern world. They don't want to understand the world. They don't want to understand the cosmos. They don't want to understand whether there is God or there is none. They want to understand just the modern world. And this is also about Marcos. You notice, perhaps, he's not interested in Greek philosophy at all. Marx was interested. Bracket. But he is not interested in, was not interested in medieval, not in the Renaissance. And even in moderns, knows nothing about, real about Descartes, nothing real about Bacon, nothing real about Hobbes and Locke, although his concept of labor, the whole conception that only labor creates wealth, is a Lockean conception. Because in the two essays on government, Locke was the first who said, from the wealth was an important category in Marx, wealth, human wealth, we create human wealth. That is, Locke said 99% of human wealth is created by labor, only 1% is due to nature. That was Locke, and that was basically Marx also believed, that since use value becomes value for us only if it is in a mixed with labor, just like Locke said. Only labor makes something valuable to us. We create wealth with human labor. And that was one point which was very problematic when the ecological consciousness of our time would not agreed at this point, neither with Marcus nor with Marx, but I think that it's very important that it was the 19th century where everyone believed in science. Science was the god. Yeah, no destination is the god. At that time, science was the god. Everyone wanted to be scientific, and to be a philosopher is something most important. We all are scientists. Marcus no more. Although he also wanted to be a scientist, but he knew that he was a scientist in a different way than the 19th century thinkers, philosophers like Karl Marx or even Freud believed that they were scientists and not philosophers. His position is in this case different. Back to the question of interpretandum and interpretation. Marcus wrote a very interesting and very informative and challenging paper in a Hungarian journal at that time, and that was the different trends, 10 tendencies in Marxism. That was the title. And he described 4 different tendencies of Marxism. 4 kind of reading. Now, one reads it this way, the other reads it that way, and the third and the fourth read it again in another way. Among the 3 readings of Marx, the fourth readings was Marxism-Leninism. That was the official Marxism of the government, official of our party. So that was only one among the 4 interpretations, and he was very scientific. He said he did not tell us which interpretation he prefers. He had his preferences. All philosophers have his preferences. But it was obvious he did not prefer Marxism-Leninism. But it was not important. He wanted to describe how a text can be read in different ways. That Otto Bauer and Kautsky read it in a way, or Engels also read it in a way, and that Lenin read it in a different kind of way, and that Althusser read it also a different kind of way, and of course the philosophy of praxis. It was at that time basically represented by the Yugoslavian philosophers, interpreted Marx again a different way about the thesis of Feuerbach, in thesis 11, and this was a total different kind of basis for interpretation. But you see, that was a tradition that the Book of Nature can be read in various ways, and now the Book of History is read in different ways. And Karl Marx embodied one of the readings of the Book of History, and through Karl Marx also read the Book of History. And although, obviously, in the case of alienation paradigm, which was very characteristic on the Paris manuscript, already the conception of grand narrative was there in Marx, not in his dissertation about Epicurus and Democritus, but in this Paris manuscript, you already know that there is the grand narrative, alienation, and take back the alienation, and the future is a kind of communism and what comes after communism, the real history, the history till now, the real history of future, of course, a certain kind of about the 1,000 years of empire, 1,000-year empire, but it's a little bit a religious conception, but it is a very, I would say, a philosophical and not religious conception all the same. So it's not Joachim Del Fiore. There is something Joachim Del Fiore, also in Marx, but not in Marcus, because Marcus was interested very much in the emergence of modernity and the structure of modernity, but he was less interested in the future. He was not really interested in activities, actions, who had a kind of, I would say, involvement in a future which is entirely different from the present. Nothing was more far away from Marcus than a kind of utopianism. That's why we quarreled a lot, because I was a new leftist, and he said that's a stupid saying, you should not. So that's also, he was anti-romantic and speaking about the future, dreaming about the future, also in End of Alienation, etc. That was a very romantic concept in a conception in his mind. Now, I need to continue because time will go out. Markus in Australia, in Sydney. Now when he came to Sydney, he became a member of a department, you know about it, which was a general philosophy department. A general philosophy department was very leftist, but different kind of leftism. And there was a German orientation, there was of course a French orientation, and whether you want the French or German orientation, a different kind of leftism, different kind of radicalism. And so Markus decided that he cannot in Australia continue with philosophy of science, because every conservative person writes about nothing but philosophy of science. So now he is in this department, and it is very dear to his heart. Then he dropped philosophy of science and returned to a kind of Marx interpretation, which had nothing, not directly to do with Marx, but with the grandchildren of Marx, or the children of Marx. These grandchildren became very important for him, because the grandchildren spoke about philosophy of culture. Once upon a time, Markus wrote about Lukács, there was only one very important thing in his life, that was culture. So now it turned out that Markus got very close to Lukács in this respect, that for him, culture, philosophy of culture, became the most important branch of philosophy. He was interested, passionately interested in it. But at the same time, he remained a scientist. When I mean scientist, I do not mean a natural scientist, although he respected natural science not in a pragmatic way, not in a way producing and productivity, not in the way the paradigm of production. For him, natural science was not a productive force. It was very anti-Marxian in this respect. Was not a productive force. It belonged to culture as much as philosophy of literature. It belonged to culture. He never mentioned religion among the appearances, manifestations of culture. Spoke only about philosophy and the arts in general, whatever art it was, and science, natural science. They were the branches of culture, and he never spoke about religion as a part of culture, which I criticize him, but that's another matter, because he's put a very great emphasis, it's important, on Hegel's philosophy of religion. And maybe you remember the Hegel's philosophy of religion. At the end, Hegel tells the student that philosophy cannot replace religion, because philosophy that cannot constitute congregations. That something happened with this absolute spirit, that philosophy cannot take a place which gives the humans meaning for their life on this earth. So that was Hegel. He said that, what can I say, says Hegel? I can say that the eternal disappears. That was his words. No, the eternal disappears. And that was favorite by Dury, by Markus, was favorite. This because he believed that Hegel is great, because he realizes that what he did in his metaphysical subjectivity, that did not work. It does not work. And his great love of Hegel was always finished with this idea. Hegel recognized that his metaphysical subjectivity does not work. Something else should work, but Markus never knew what's going to work. Because Markus was, well, him, everything was about thinking. But he never believed that he can create an answer to the questions. He could ask the questions of our time, and his questions are always about modernity. How modernity came into being? What are the characteristics of modernity? How different philosophers approach modernity? But he never spoke about the future of this modernity. This I mentioned already. No utopia, where the present is, we have to speak about the present. If there is a future, it is the future of the present. It's not a future which transcends the present. This kind of ideas which I shared in Marx, that Markus never shared with us, because for him, although he never shared also Hegel's conception, the end of history, but he did not know what's going on next in history, although history has not ended, and Hegel could have known it.
2 minutes.
Yeah, two minutes. All right, then I say, take only one word about Marcuse's cognitive empathy, because I spoke already about this. What is cognitive empathy? Marcuse wrote only about authors whom he loved, because he liked to write about people with whom he could feel empathy. Empathy even for their failing, not only for their success. Only for the feeling they have is empathy. That's a cognitive empathy, because it's not about the heart, but it was an empathy of the brain. But he did not like polemics. He never polemizes. But there were a lot of philosophers. I mentioned Heidegger for one, but the others. He did not like Derrida. But he never polemicizes, because this contradicts his cognitive empathy. He has to love someone in order to speak about this one. That's why he spoke about Marx, spoke about Adorno, spoke about, and of course about Walter Benjamin, who was closest to him, and to mention, because at the end of my talk, that he's, for him, the representative philosopher was and remained Kant. Kant was in the center of modernity, and Kant was not because he knew the answers, but he knew the questions. And the questions raised by Kant, and we do not know better answer to these questions either. That it was, this went together with his great love for Karl Marx as well, as the great philosopher of modernity. But Kant together with Marx, that is not a bad combination in my mind. But I think in Marcuse's case, that ought to be a very good combination. Thank you. I know my time. I ran out of time.
Thank you very much. Yeah. All right, for the last presentation, you can pan out.
So Professor Heller mentioned that Marcuse never spoke about the future sort of on principle, because the target, his target was the present. You could say the same thing about Marx, of course, who whose criticism was of capitalism as it exists and its internal logic. I'm going to risk being a romantic musician of sorts, and possibly even contradicting myself in using Marcuse in some way, or appropriating Marcuse in some way, to ask questions about potential socialist formation, the building of socialist culture. So I want to at least issue the disclaimer that I could be completely wrong in interpreting Marcuse's spirit, but I'm going to give it a stab anyway, and I think it will continue this discussion with some continuity. So first I wanted to just thank the HM organizers. That would be Aaron here. Also, he is somebody who was special for, you know, including me on this panel, which I'm humbled to be a part of. I've been reading Marcuse for about a year now. That's about 9 years less than Jonathan, and several years fewer than Professor Heller as well. But what I've come to realize in studying him quite deeply is that he's one of the deepest readers of Marx, I think, and certainly the deepest thinker on Marxism and its relation to culture for our time. In contrast to the two eminent philosophers sitting to my left, I've pursued a vocation in a parallel, but perhaps at times competing field of high culture. That would be art and music, dedicating part of my spare time to my political and philosophical interests in Marxism and critical theory. I say competing because, at least since German idealism and the coinciding rise of music as an autonomous art, music and philosophy have vied for preeminence at times in speaking to collective human truth, however that might be conceived by the artists and philosophers. Whereas in 1810, Beethoven is said to have remarked that, quote, music is a higher revelation than philosophy, Hegel in the same period would claim precisely the opposite, that philosophy, not fine art, is the vocation that attains the highest understanding of spirit.
As I see it, it was only with Marx's materialist intervention a few decades later that a potential alternative was posed to both Beethoven's and Hegel's competing claims. And I think it was George Marcus's great contribution over the past half century to articulate how this nexus of high culture and historical materialism set the parameters of free experience under modernity and defined the continued prospect of building a better human future. What I find satisfying and useful in Marcus's reading of this Hegelian Marxist tradition of philosophy and critical theory through Lukács and the Frankfurt School and up to the present is how it carefully exposes the aporias and antinomies at the heart of ideology critique and aesthetic theory in such a way that, for me, maps the possible ways this tradition might be continued with a synthesized historical materialist praxis. I hope here to make a modest contribution to this project, one that draws from my own experience in and research into musical reproduction under capitalism, and which recruits aspects of Marcus's theoretical paradigm in charting the political significance of what admittedly otherwise seems like a marginal apolitical activity, playing the piano. Though I will concentrate my attention on this seemingly esoteric cultural activity, the specialized domain of art music and performance practice that I happen to be intimately familiar with, this all will serve only as a means to an end. My ultimate goal is to arrive at and open a discussion on the place of high culture in contemporary left revolutionary theory and practice. I don't claim to have any grand formulas for resolving the tense relationships between art and politics. I know I'm not the first one to broach the subject. But I do think the tension still matters and deserves a place at the table in the ongoing efforts to build a movement for radical democratic change like the ones being discussed in this building currently. In his essay, Hegel and the End of Art, Marcus discusses art's attempt to, quote, address itself to the ultimate questions of the age, which Hegel thinks will inevitably falsify the complex reality of modernity. The new self-conscious autonomous art can explore man's finitude in infinite ways and disclose how spirit suffuses and enlivens that finite reality, but it cannot disclose spirit itself as the universally valid, community-ensuring set of binding norms. Marcus refers to the, quote, what he calls the indubitable effectiveness of Hegel's thesis, specifically the, quote, radicalness with which it identifies the problematic situation of modern art, the lack of clarity and the insecurity surrounding its social relevance and cultural accomplishment. What art loses upon winning autonomy is the power to reveal an immediate link between individual and society in such a way as to bestow upon subjects a practical spiritual orientation towards living with each other. Yet this is also a gain in the sense that now art is free, in its free subjective phase, it can explore, in whatever limited context, new imaginative and creative human possibilities and potentials. Though Marcus doesn't broach the subject in this Hegel essay, I would add that these possibilities inscribed in high cultural forms could not become fully realized without some socio-political incorporation, which I imagine would entail revolution. And that might be a subject we can discuss later, if that's one you guys are interested in. I would leave it to Professor Heller and Jonathan to discuss whether Marcus's theory of culture is meant to concern the activities of revolutionaries in terms that would ultimately address Hegel's problematic that I just posed. If so, I would argue that his conception of cultural creation, of how cultural creations are produced, may give a clue. One of the constant reference points for Marcus's theory of modern culture is the triadic relation of author, work, recipient, which Jonathan mentioned, encompassing both the arts and the sciences as they prevailed during the 19th century and partially into the 20th. I think Marcus calls this the classic modern paradigm of not paradigm, but triad of cultural productive relations. Meaning that it doesn't exactly exist with the same force, normative force, as it used to. it's been problematized, but this author-work recipient relation still prevails in some way. Marcus discusses the requirement of novelty in the sciences and originality in the arts, which any cultural object must meet to be accepted as a contribution to the expansion and enlargement of the human spirit and human capacities. Understanding how the work is problematized in musical production can frame a problem that I think is useful in discussing the question of how Marcus's work might relate to a socialist project. A musical performer's role in the tripartite scheme has undergone an ambiguous historical development ever since the performer achieved interpretive autonomy from both composer and listener in the past 200 years or so. How the performer chooses to exercise this autonomy, I argue, has important political implications, or they can be drawn from it. The author-work recipient relation is complicated in musical production since, besides the author and recipient, there is a third individual whose role it is to make the work itself audible. This third individual's role can variously be designated as more or less active, depending on how finished one imagines the work, and in a related way, whether this intermediary performer identifies more on the side of the composer or on the side of the listener. If the performer identifies on the listener, recipient side, it is because they see somehow the work as whole and complete, and therefore only in need of interpretation, so that by the end of a performance, the originally finished work is doubly interpreted, first by the performer, and then in a secondary and highly mediated fashion by the listener. Disputes then ensue about whether the performer was sufficiently faithful to the work in question to have properly demonstrated its excellence, or if the performer interpreted too much, thus injecting or perhaps superimposing too much of her own personality into the work, such that the result is a distorted counterfeit of the composer's original intention. Conversely, the listener may seek out and identify with the performer whose personal interpretations, annotations, creative distortions are heard as enhancing or shedding light on the work in some way or another, precisely because too many predictable, standardized, and so-called faithful performances have already been delivered and recorded. If the intermediary musical performer identifies with the composer, on the other hand, then a very different picture develops. It is assumed by the performer not that they are in one way or another superior to the composer or the composition, but that they see the composition as essentially incomplete or at least underdetermined. This intermediary performer identifies as a collaborator alongside the composer, whose labor determined a set of potentials and parameters inscribed in the notated score through which the second composer then contributes decisions that further this labor and ultimately finish it in an act of audible realization of a piece that is still conventionally recognized as the intellectual property of the composer whose autograph headlines the score. While the second composer may appear to occupy a secondary, subservient, and fundamentally uncreative task in relation to the first composer, given that the former's remaining decisions are so narrowed and conditioned by the original decisions of the composer, in fact, the leap from the score to sound requires its own distinctly original creative contribution. It requires one to solve a puzzle not merely on the textual dimension at the level of the score, but in relation to the live act of physical acoustical coordination and generation of meaning complex for the listener. In her essay, Autonomy of Art or the Dignity of the Artwork, Professor Heller addresses the special case of musical performance in considering the question of whether the dignity of art is in any way diminished over the course of its mechanical reproduction in the 20th century. She writes, quote, "The musical score is the artwork. It is an end in itself, and interpretation is not just a means, as it shares the personality of the work. The question is," she asks, "is my recording of Beethoven's Piano Sonata 31 in A flat major, played by Glenn Gould, which has been reproduced many thousands of times, an artwork or not?" The personality is in the score, she writes. As every performance, that is, every interpretation shares the score, so does every copy of the same performance. Gould himself would no doubt have agreed. And it was apt for Professor Heller to choose Glenn Gould as an example in light of our present discussion. This is because Gould pioneered the notion of the musical performer as a kind of second composer, an author in their own right, whose very activity concretizes the score's latent personality through an original, innovative contribution. Gould saw mechanical production not as a barrier to the dissemination of a higher truth through music, but its principal means. In a post-war era during which time Gould, along with Marcus, recognized the author-work recipient triad as being challenged by new material developments of modernity, he no longer saw the point of musical performance that merely codified prior masterworks in sound, a project Gould claimed already in the late 50s to have been accomplished for most of the canon, meaning Glenn Gould in 1958 said something like, every great masterwork has already been recorded and codified at the level of sound. If you're still playing the piano, you have to do something new. But what will that be? Sorry, let me find where I was. Just wrapping up now. I have to get back. Here we are. This is the problem. When you flip these, everything goes away. Okay. Rather, the point was to approach the material objectivations of the past, especially those most typifying the self-sufficient character of the human spirit, and reabsorb them, reproduce them. Gould showed us a way to achieve this that both channels the promise latent in the history of high culture and actively renews that promise in the present, not through an act of deference or subordination or blind orthodoxy, but through an original act of production, drawing on the exemplary works of the past. His great contribution to musical production was to settle the problem of interpretive agency by providing a revolutionary path forward that seeks to transcend the present cultural relations of modernity in favor of an ecstatic, emancipatory new order. The chief limitation of his project, one which Hegel would have foresaw, was to attempt this revolutionary act in the realm of art alone. Nonetheless, his efforts can be a lesson for those seeking parallel ends in instituting new norms in the broader realm of culture. There is a point to my discussing this challenge to the dominant paradigm of musical performance, in which the performer presupposes the received work as a finished whole, awaiting a subordinate act of mere interpretation. Such a reorientation of a performer's musical priorities is tantamount to a historical materialist musical practice, I argue. One that I suggest has extra musical implications, insofar as it relates to the broader project of forging a viable socialist culture. My goal is not to save classical music or high culture, but to suggest that it might be possible to realize those values through the development of and participation in a revolutionary movement to transform society itself and the social relations of production. Can this be done musically? What could that question even mean in the abstract? Whom are we playing for and why? What do we believe about this music? What goals does it serve? What institutions does it perpetuate? Where does music education fit in? What must be preserved? Does it have a place in a non-alienated society? If it does, how can it help us get there? Art music's autonomy symbolically relates through analogy to human autonomy. How can we reestablish the link between the two? And is that even our principal goal? There are many more questions here, but the point is that any discussion of the future of art music, or the future of a possible better world, must address these contradictions and commit themselves to a more thoroughgoing transformation of society, in which culture is paramount. I think any other route would be seriously flawed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all, our panelists.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.